My name is Michael. I am a adjunct working professor at a couple of schools in Kansas City. So I teach at multiple different schools to put together a paycheck. And I also am somebody who's really interested in poetry and philosophy research, mostly done independently because, again, I also don't necessarily fit traditional academic channels. So, yeah, I want to put that challenge out, the one between maybe a kind of more individualistic, you got to hustle for your money versus a kind of solidarity union-based approach.
Right.
But also, I'm actually kind of pro-cancel culture, pro-SJW. I identify as a socialist and anti-racist and feminist. So I don't necessarily see like public call-outs as necessarily this terrible thing to worry about, because I see that as part of an engaged public, and that often like that is a recourse for people who are abusers and stuff. So to me, I think that maybe part of kind of adding to the individual versus solidarity with other academic workers thing is that maybe actually that maybe that also kind of falls on that axis a little bit, that if you're maybe more open to, say, questions of equality and oppression, it can open up other ways to enrich and better the academy than just kind of breaking off and just doing a kind of like hustle on Twitter thing.
Yeah, well, I definitely appreciate all of that. And I also thought long and hard about all of that. I mean, for what it's worth, I think it's kind of interesting to note that I identify as a communist and an anti-racist also. And so, you know, I actually don't think we're too far apart. I think part of it is disposition. I think some people will be more suited to taking an outside route, and some people will be more suited to taking an inside route. And part of that is just personality traits, which different people are blessed with differently, right? So like I have a very anarchistic temperament. I just don't do well personally with following strictures and, you know, being super patient with all kinds of rules and stuff like that. And so that's a kind of not very interesting answer, but it is, I think, an important part of the answer. So people who are trying to fix academia from the inside, they have nothing but my support and encouragement, for what it's worth. I personally, the way I evaluated the situation when I was in academia was that it just had the overwhelming feeling of a sinking ship in pretty much every way. And, you know, I also am supportive of unions, for what it's worth. But it would be boring if I just basically said I agree in principle with everything you said. So I'll kind of purposely choose to take the most kind of conflictual angle I can find in what you're saying. I'm sympathetic to unions. I would love to see academic unions create better living conditions for adjuncts and stuff like that. The issue is that I do somewhat doubt the larger agenda that is kind of underlying the kind of progressive academic culture in a way that I wouldn't necessarily even blame any individuals for. I think that there is an agenda there. There is a kind of underlying machinery that you have to buy into to be a part of that game and to play that game and to be rewarded within that game. And I think that underlying machinery is at a very deep level corrupt in a way that I find kind of horrifying. And interestingly, you can say this, you can make this argument even from a left-wing perspective. So as I'm sure you're aware, there is this kind of 1968 and post-1968 kind of anarchist kind of strand of the left. This is absolute kind of left-wing territory that says unions are actually representatives of capital more so than representatives of liberation. The union is actually where, you know, in today's language, we might call it the professional managerial class, if you will, or, you know, woke capital or neoliberal capital or whatever you want to call it. The unions are actually where kind of the genuine emancipatory desires of the working class are essentially choked and controlled and maintained by the dominant forces of the capital machinery. And frankly, I'm quite sympathetic to that viewpoint. That does seem to be a pretty plausible reading of the history of union struggles and how they play out or don't play out. So, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I would love to see a union succeed in making, you know, life better for all adjuncts and somehow kind of like creating better working conditions. But I'm afraid I don't think that's really what's going on. But I should.
One of the things, and this is one of the words that people use a lot. They kind of talk about a materialist approach or something. And for me, where I see a lot of the maybe where there's a lot of misinterpretation of why people talk about why and how people talk about racism and sexism and economic inequality and just the apparatus of imperialism that I'm opposed to, is that we see them entirely as ideas. And so when we fight over those, when we fight over these real things that are taking place, things that actually are killing disproportionately Black and brown people and immiserating a lot of people, we kind of get in this trap where it becomes debating the ideas itself. And when people say, who disagree for whatever reason they do, get a lot of people pissed off at them, it sort of then becomes only about, oh, they're sort of being criticized for their ideas and not for maybe where they stand in a real struggle. And so for me, the fact that there is a revitalization of the union movement happening alongside, say, this wave of uprisings, and just a resurgent left in general, is because people are really naming the struggle for what it is. Because I imagine that a lot of us are kind of stuck in this, you know, really difficult, kind of miserable hustle that you seem to have gotten out of it in some way. And that naming it in terms of that struggle means that people are going to get pissed off and cancel each other. And that's kind of almost part of the game for me. And so that's kind of, again, why I'm always urging people to worry a little bit less about cancel culture, because I think it obscures a much, much more real fight that people are dying from and that we can actually give our solidarity to.
Could I suggest something real quick? I feel like we're all nice guys here, so we're being very kind, and we're kind of blunting many edges here to the point that this is going to get, I think, very boring for us here and also for people listening. So I think, like, we're nice, so we need to kind of go out of our way to make the edges a little bit sharper. So
yeah, like, I could do that.
Well, I was going to take a stab at it if someone else can, you want.
Please,
yeah.
Please, go ahead.
Oh, so like, yeah, this is what happens when you actually talk with people face to face. People generally agree about most important things, right? It's like things are not that conflictual. And then we go online, we go on Twitter, and it's like the whole country is aflame with like insane culture wars, right? So we need to try to like connect with what's actually really kicking off in a crazy way, right? So I'm just going to purposely be more provocative and hope that kind of gets things going. At stake here is like, we can do some sort of like kind of inane conception of cancel culture where it's like, oh, it's not that bad. But what's really at stake here for people who are concerned about cancel culture is that people's position in society is being radically and suddenly demoted for saying true things. Like, that's what's really at stake here. It's that it's not the fact that people's, you know, status can go up and down. That's reasonable enough, right? No big deal. Let's not shed any tears about someone losing status. But the problem is that there are true things that if you say them, you die socially. Like, that's the scary thing here. Okay. That'd be my provocation.
And give us an example of one.
Take one example that is like mildly provocative, but not so provocative it's going to like ruin the whole conversation, would probably be the existence of IQ as a phenomenon that's real. Another one would, here's a better one. Psychological sex differences. So the simple fact that men and women on average have different averages of psychological traits. So my understanding as a social scientist is that this is uncontroversially true over the course of many years and many, many, many studies on certain psychological traits. There are different averages for men and women. Okay. This is something that you're not allowed to say as an employee of a large corporate organization such as Google. That's the James Damore case. It's also widely to connect this to people like Michael and make the conversation more interesting. This is the type of scientific truth that that in pretty much any graduate school in any like humanities department across the country, if you say it, you're seen as evil pretty much. And there's a serious risk of there being major political campaign against you for saying this in the presence of polite company within a kind of respectable humanities grad school. So take that as an example. Let's work with that. How about that?
So if I sound a little bit better now.
Oh yeah, perfect.
Oh, loud and clear, man. You're good now.
Perfect.
Awesome. So the whole point I was trying to make ultimately is that like the second order consequences of a lot of this stuff is actually detrimental. Just like Justin said, you can't talk about anything. We're at the point where it's now become counterproductive, and if you mention truth in any regard, not just in the case of like more academic things like IQ, but also in the case of like, oh, maybe there's like biological sex, that's like unacceptable, or like, oh, maybe there is some level of manipulation from like corporations with respect to this like woke politic, like all this stuff you're not allowed to say, and it will ultimately ruin your social standing and your career and amongst other things. So it's like we're just at a point where it's become so counterproductive that it starts to polarize people, right? So because if you're canceled for saying something mundane, you might as well say like Nazi stuff, like you might as well go all out, like truthfully, like that's what, like you just, if you can't say like basic truth that we all know intuitively to be true, what's the, like you might as well just be a skinhead at that point.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you actually do believe there's some sort of like crazy Jewish conspiracy, because actually there are actually people on the internet who tell you you're not allowed to say something that's patently true. Like, of course you're going to start thinking crazy shit.
But can I go on a bit of a different sort of approach?
Hold on,
can
I just want to address that first. I feel like on this show in particular, there's been like jokes that I've never encountered like really anywhere in my life.
Really?
Like everyone's, I think this all comes from Stephen Molyneux is upset that he has this like weird tweet where he's like, look at all the people working in media. They all have the same religion.
No, but everyone,
people know that. That's not, nobody, that's not a conspiracy.
Can we not talk about the
No, but that's, okay. You can exfoliate the conversation. You can exfoliate the conversation. I think that is a fine thing to say, right? They all disagree with each other. That's not one monolith, just like anywhere else or anyone else. And they have a very great culture to learn from, right? This is a culture show.
Hey, are we talking about Jewish shit right now?
I'm just trying to.
Jules.
Because it's like,
I'm a curious guest. He's referencing previous episodes.
Michael is the courageous defender here. So
like, yes. This is not, I'm not saying.
Because what I'm actually trying to say is like, I'm not sure if like people are sort of broaching a sort of sympathy for like anti-Semitism or something
oh,
like that.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like it's kind of coming up, and it's I almost don't would feel kind of frustrated to have to simultaneously defend, you know, the values that I hold dear as well as the religion that I hold. That would be a kind of confusing spot for me to be in.
Absolutely not. Jules was just referring to stuff that was happening in the past
on the show.
It's been anonymous accounts.
It's been from anonymous accounts. And so what Bears was saying is that this could be a symptom of like people being angry and venting about stupid shit, right? And they're also trying to get people inflamed and flared up, because I guess that's how they feel.
Yeah,
right?
But
I would sharpen that.
You
have people pulling down stacks.
Jules, you know? Yes, we understand. Justin.
Oh, I just wanted to sharpen that a little bit more to make the conversation even more clear, I think. In addition to what Jules said, which I agree with, what Verz and I were really getting at, I think, the crux of this is that what's really at stake with cancel culture and Michael's, you know, very nice defense of the political logic and the political kind of class warfare that is actually at play in cancel culture, which many people see as a legitimate fight for justice. What is really at stake here for me that makes me less enthusiastic about it and more concerned than Michael is that it is about politically overriding what is true. And when you politically override what is true, then it leads to crazy ripples in the cognitive social fabric, one of which is people believing in idiotic and nasty conspiracy theories, such as anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So it's like, for my mental model is, we either have the truth, and the truth is the truth. It's an objective, there are objective truths exists, and we have intersubjective protocols for determining what is objectively true. It's called scientific method. That can be a legitimate, modern, rational centering or anchoring mechanism for a complex society of many people. If you think that you can have a political program that is going to, through political power as a type of class warfare, which you think is legitimate and justified, if you think that you can enact rules on society as a whole about what is going to be counted as true, then you are opening up the conditions for the possibility of things like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Because if you don't have objective truth to hold everyone accountable, then everyone gets to make up their own self-interested theories. And that's the genie you're letting out of the bottle if you support cancel culture.
No,
that's my contention. Yeah,
two comments that – actually, no, Gio, I'll let you speak and then I'll make kind of
no,
two comments.
No, I was – going to, oh man, this kabobulin. Justin, I think the problem is that we're thinking sort of on the, I get what you're saying about objective truth, but I think you have to sort of get rid of that language of let's call it Anglo-empiricism. I don't think that to notice patterns is in particular considered racist or anti-Semitic or so forth. But I think what we're thinking of here is the first order of you are a person in position and you get quote-unquote canceled because you said something, you're broaching a certain research topic. I think it goes deeper than that. And to respect to Professor Mile, is that how you pronounce it?
Hessel Mile.
Yeah, Professor Hessel Mile. Now, I'm not going to lie, okay? I had a pretty good time in the institution. I chose not to go to the PhD level. I've certainly achieved the master's level, but people were open and they knew about, because I went to a sort of a saner university and I had professors that read my stuff. But I think the problem is that we seem to talk about the reality of canceling. We're not talking about the sort of the hidden integers that go behind the actual things like hiring processes and union representation and so forth, because my argument is that to even achieve an academic position, you have to have a certain temperament, certainly a certain class, a certain way of viewing the world that I think gets selected. Now, I may be biased because I'm somewhat on the outs, especially in the Canadian standards, but I think that this issue of this, you know, basic normie, let's call it the normie conservative view of, well, this professor got canceled for saying something bold. I think that it goes deeper. It's certainly the class of academia itself, I believe, selects for and cultivates a certain mindset that is more intangible than just saying this professor got canceled. Now, we could talk about that. I think that's something that a lot of critics of cancel culture miss, is that the sort of cancellation goes on a much more latent or let's call it a cathartic level than just saying this professor got fired or whatnot. Because to even get to that position, I think is more of a struggle than what people believe. So,
oh man, I wanted to defend the institution, but I definitely need to let the good professor here speak first.
So kind of stepping back to respond to Justin's point, I think one thing, and this is part of the move that we make when we talk about ourselves as pointing only to things that are true, it just happens to be objective, is that that's not always at stake in these kinds of struggles. So for example, the idea that, say, in-baked sexed or racial differences are true in the particular kind of way that some people want to defend, that's not necessarily an ironclad truth that people can be so confident in. So part of, for example, when we talk about, say, cultural differences, we see an enormous plasticity in how people express social conventions, how people convey gender, and often ways that recognize the wide variety of forms of gender expression that the last couple hundred years of history have sought to maybe erase. And so when we kind of say, oh, I'm being punished because it's because I said it was true that, like, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, like, I think when people talk about, say, biological research, most of the time, stuff like that isn't what's at stake. It's about the norms that we try to impose on that data. Because at the end of the day, and I'm going to kind of go against, say, the kind of Steven Pinker anti-blank slate thing, human consciousness is much, much more plastic and malleable and improvable than any idea that would try to impose people as being set in a particular way. And I think that that's something that's worth kind of fighting for. And so that's why I'm really pushing back on this idea of truth, because sure, you can get maybe someone, and I'm going to just be kind of digging here, someone say from the Pioneer Fund, and they'll kind of get some numbers together. But is that going to be rooted in anything? Is that going to necessarily be true just because it's a number on a piece of paper? Part of the scientific method is that it actually is an intersubjective experience, exactly like you said, and it is a struggle as well. And so again, the struggle is in the science. The politics are in the science. We can't escape that and just say, this is just some reality, because we're in the middle of defining it for ourselves right now. So that was fun.
Yeah. This furthers Justin's point and mine earlier as well. If you have that level of malleability when it comes to like what truth is, if you could just create a narrative above on that you can like use to string together evidence, there is absolutely nothing stopping you from creating actual like harmful rhetoric or act
like a power knowledge dumb idea, in other words.
Yeah, I can make whatever conspiracy theory I want if I can read statistics the correct way. Like that's part of like I like my
oh, degree propagandist here.
Yeah, I mean like yeah, no for real though. Like my degree's in math. I could take, you know, a bunch of stats and like empirical research and string it together and make something insane. That's part of what I do on my brand. Like it's literally just like you are creating this monster by removing the tether to objective reality. In the case
and
of like
since
to pursue a political
that's
narrative.
The world we live in, part of what we have to figure out is how to navigate that. And I don't think that simply calling objective reality safe from our consciousness is gonna save us from that path.
So I think this is actually really, this is really interesting. It's really revealing in a good way, because I think what's kind of coming through now is that, Michael, you seem to be, and I applaud you for this. You're fairly transparently, if I hear you correctly, you're kind of biting the bullet and saying that yes, at the end of the day, it does boil down to different groups having different normatively imposed combinations of fact and story and norms, and that ultimately it's just a class war between different competing factions and their stories. Would you bite that bullet? Is that fair to say?
Yes. And
so then you can't say that the anti-Jewish conspiracy theorists are wrong, because that would be crazy, nasty, like anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists are less correct than you, or in any way inferior to your story. You are implicitly invoking some sort of external intersubjective criteria, aka scientific method on some level, which is what I'm trying to defend, because I don't want anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists to think that they're right.
I'm gonna need you to boil that down a little bit more.
I'm happy to. Where should I start? Tell me, John.
So, there is an objective reality that we are all grasping for. I'm doing my best here. There is an objective reality that we're all grasping for, and I think we're all on team. Let's try to get human knowledge as close to objective reality as we.
No, can. No, I'm not sure that Michael believes that. Michael seems to be, and it's a perfectly reasonable position.
Actually,
many.
Because the point isn't that we entirely create our reality. But our understanding of it is a shared and social and political experience, which is why I'm saying that the things that are being called objective facts, which tend to say support, say systems of inequality that people created, are the things that we need to hold and suspend.
Right.
And So it really is folding in the facts with the interpretation, which is, and so I would argue that your belief, say in IQ or something like that, is maybe something that needs to actually be challenged and thematized a little bit more, rather than just kind of framing it as you found the truth that people seem to be happy to sell to you, and that you're only sparking controversy instead of, say, taking an actual position on systems of inequality that, again, murder people.
I can't live.
But why is equality?
I'm not okay with the reality.
That's the image of thought. Like, why is it the equality? Why is that the defining metric to begin with? I think that's what Justin's getting at. You've sort of already set out a worldview, a Weltschulung position to begin with. Like, why is that particular image of thought so vital to any sort of political or sociological or cultural discourse?
I feel like it's definitionally, isn't it? Like,
because I think it is fundamentally rooted in who we are, that we're actually better equipped to be working that way, but we tend to distract ourselves a little bit.
Just a short aside.
What if you encounter, like, this is what I mean, this is what I'm getting at. A person, let's say a thinker whose fundamental position is not that of equality, but rather of hierarchy, of reaction, and so forth, they sort of are left wanting in any sort of academic system. So I think... I agree with you. I totally agree with the social constructionist position. I am not, to Justin here, an Anglo-empiricist. But at the same time, when people that you sort of slant as reactionaries or the far right or so forth are coming to the same conclusions but differently, how are their assumptions somewhat problematic or toxic or othering compared to any other sort of form?
I feel like your brain falls out when you think so hard that you're okay with genocide. I think to use the Jewish or Armenian example.
No, but I'm not talking about genocide. I'm just saying that.
I mean, that's the ipso facto conclusion.
Or re-education camps.
I would class the difference between can't like
yeah I'm fine with that too.
Re-education camps. So out of the loop in this conversation, I'm like trying to follow it.
Let me just jump in. So effectively, what we've gotten to is there's consensus reality, and then we're now arguing over what the basis of this consensus ought to be, right? Yeah. So is the basis of this consensus
that's a good point
pushing towards like removing inequality in systems, or can I just make up the basis as I want if I can get enough people to agree with me? So that's what makes the Jewish conspiracy things pop up on the internet. If you can get enough people to go, yes, the Jews, now you have a new consensus reality that has to battle with anti-oppression.
Wait, Michael, Justin, we can't hear you.
No, but it doesn't have to be Jews. It doesn't have to be genocide. I'm just saying.
No, now we can hear you.
In general, any sort of theorizing of a system, we all have our fundamental assumptions, but I'm saying that some fundamental assumptions that are qualitative rather than quantitative, they tend not to be taken up with such a scrutiny compared to others, right? I mean, that's...
I mean, if you want, I can...
You might be surprised by how much hierarchy and reaction there is even baked into other disciplines that are seen as liberal. I think that's kind of why the word liberal is it's kind of a word that masks a lot of different things. To some, it means far left. To some, it means capitalism.
Like postmodernism.
So for example, I'm partly bringing this up just because I want to mention it, but say the way we talk about fighting crime, for example, is one that's extremely hierarchical and top down. It has no respect for the ability for communities to say protect themselves in ways that don't involve empowering someone to push people around and kill them, you know. And so that's something that's totally validated.
Well, let's try it out then in a certain community and see what happens. I'd be very interested. This is why we had various experiments over the centuries of different political systems, and we could see whether East Germany went to West Germany or West German people went to East Germany. That's how a lot of these things end up getting decided. One quick aside, I don't want to take up too much time. I just want to mention that since you're very into Jewish mysticism, I am someone who has looked deeply into, I looked into Yehuda Ashlag, who is this rebellious Kabbalist, who is the one who
wanted a Kabbalist and a socialist.
But here's the thing. He said that communism was destined to fail, and his intent was for people to be able to one day, through studying the Kabbalah, get to that level of consciousness where they would be able to do it, unlike, let's say, having certain social engineers try to impose this on people and making all the toilet paper run out, as has happened in Russia, where I was born in.
So I think in general, you made a really good point, which is that looking at historical examples is a really great opportunity to see all these, to see how things have played out. And I will just insist as a kind of epistemological thing, and this is me defending some truth here. This is me throwing some truth bombs that I think actually are being suppressed, is that there are examples all over the world of people practicing anarchy, including ones that happened literally weeks ago, but also in different cultures and and at different points, even in traditional European descended civilization. And you can see where and when it doesn't work, and it gives you opportunities to perfect those tools. That's a fundamental tenet of Marxism, is actually the ability to learn and adapt.
Where does it work? Give me an example. And I'm not talking about like that place in Denmark or Norway. It's like a very small thing. I'm talking about like a larger society where the proletariat has seized control, the dictatorship of the proletariat, like Len was talking about. Where would you say that it has successfully worked for a long amount of time?
So I don't want to give too many hot takes, but I would actually argue that there are elements of the Soviet Union that were successful. There are certainly failures, but there actually were parts of it that were successful. For example, after collectivization, famines ended. So the last famine was in the 1930s. There were famines all through Russian history until they pursued...
Is that true?
That's bullshit.
It is true.
That's bullshit.
It is true.
It's not true.
I'm the one who was from Russia. I'm the one who has ancestors that go back there.
I respect your experience.
My great-grandmother had to live under the blockade. And you know why? It wasn't because of the Nazis. It was because the troops and the generals were intentionally blocking food from coming to the people. Instead, they had chefs there that were making all these delicious recipes for these generals, because that's the way it worked. You had thugs coming in, and you had the suppression of the true believers. Like, at first, you had the true believers. Some of them were, they had a lot of heart in it. They were the ones who were later on dealt with. And instead, you had the thugs that picked up the mantle and ran with it. And that's been seen time and time again in so many of these systems. Another thing, by the way, people love to point out about, like, oh, the CIA tried to, you know, suppress the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a fucking empire in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It had so much territory. It had so much resources. Yet in the greatest cities like St. Petersburg and Moscow, regular people could not find any toilet paper. Food was scarce. Let's not even talk about the villages that were on the outskirts. People were dying left and right. People were dying of hunger. And
the kulaks.
Yeah. Well, the kulaks, that was before. But the people who ran in the circle...
That was in the 30s.
Hold on, Jules. The people who ran in the circles of my family, they got into mental institutions. They were forced in there because they read the wrong book. You know, they were forced in these mental homes where they were given pills to screw their brain up intentionally to cause neurological damage that is irreversible, as an example to all the others. This is a monstrous...
Yeah, I'm just over here trying to get away from that. That's all I'm trying to do. I don't want any of that in America. I'm just trying to do my own thing.
Just falling into another sort of, like, you know, revisionism versus, you know what I mean? It's like...
All history is revisionism. So.
This is what I mean. I fundamentally agree with the professor's assumption that a lot of our truth is socially constructed. And I think that that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that's the problem with the right, is that we just haven't, well, we're starting to, but I mean, this is the problem, is that we have to challenge our assumptions and we create institutions based on certain discourses. The counter discourses, eventually, well, the pressure was a bit looser, that maybe that these, and even the term conspiracy is itself problematic, in my opinion, because what is a conspiracy, right? So this is what I think. I think we have to sort of steer clear of what we're doing now, which is engaging in, like, this is my ideology and that's my ideology and this is a counterpoint. You know what I mean? It's like, because we're going to go in this all day. I think what we're doing here on the meta level is more fundamentally, satiating, you know what I mean? So.
Mm. Well, I, for one, think that the mention of the Soviet Union is absolutely apropos in many ways, actually. It really condenses things in a certain way because, you know, what I'm detecting here, and first of all, I just want to go out of my way to say I seriously applaud Michael showing up here and representing this opinion and perspective, which is clearly not the dominant one. It's a minority opinion here, and that takes, like, courage, and I appreciate that. And Michael, I think you're representing it gracefully and as transparently as one can. And I think what I'm seeing, which is interesting, and I just want to note it, is that, and Michael, I think you're arguing in very good faith, so I'm not accusing you of anything underhanded whatsoever, but listening closely to the arguments you're putting forward, it seems to me like you are enacting a kind of classical, it's the classic Mott and Bailey logical fallacy, where you really do believe in an objective truth, and you will invoke the objective truth when it's convenient for the conclusions that you want, but then you won't, but then you say there's no ultimate objective truth. So it allows you to, depending on the position, depending on whether you're arguing in favor of someone that you like and identify with, or arguing against someone or something that you dislike and disidentify with, you can choose at different moments whether or not objective reality is in fact a constraint.
Can you please, for myself, who's qualified in both math, philosophy, and propaganda, explain what Mott and Bailey is in this?
It's where you present a certain argument, and then when you're criticized with it, you back off what you're actually stating or what you're actually committed to.
Could you give me a theoretical example? Because it's not hitting home for me, and I can't be the only person.
It's probably more confusing than is necessary. I'm just basically saying there's a logical contradiction in the actual set of positions that Michael has articulated. On certain claims, when he's talking about things that he believes in and that he likes, he will frequently invoke or refer to something like an intersubjective objective reality that is true and beyond question, and that can actually be used to sort out true and false claims. But then when I refer to the protocols of scientific method as supplying a form of objective truth constraint, that's all just political nonsense.
I don't have any point of order questions anymore, I guess, Michael. My questions were very much point of order definitional.
Okay, well, there you go. So basically all I'm really getting at is I actually think that this is the core issue. And I think if we choose to we can just choose to let it go, and differences are differences, that's fine. We can have a difference of opinion. But so long as this is allowed into the conversation, it's going to be cycling infinitely in any number of different directions that are very unsatisfying. Because I think this is essentially what was the lesson of the Soviet Union also, right? I mean, the late stage Soviet Union supplies these extraordinary episodes of obvious, clear, documented objective realities, and everyone in the society saying otherwise, right? Are we all on the same page that did happen? Even if you want to make some arguments about how the Soviet Union maybe did some things good in late stage Soviet society, this happened. This seems above dispute. Even left wing kind of defenders would probably admit to that on some level. So I think basically I believe I've diagnosed that just now. It's you either agree that there is an objective reality and classical positivist scientific method is the only intersubjective human techniques we have for calibrating different subjective preferences. There's only one, it's classical scientific method. You either submit to scientific method as being an imperfect, absolutely imperfect, and you're absolutely right, subject to different types of political compromises and political conditionings, no doubt. But those are extraneous to science. Those are human problems that are constantly popping up. But there is a thing called scientific method, and it is the only civilized method we have for calibrating competing group preferences and subjective fantasies. You either agree to that and you can have possibly a civilized society, or if you reject that, you are going to be bound up with infinite cycling kind of group warfare of competing fantasies and narratives. And it sounds like Michael...
I think it's time to let Michael...
We already have that,
yeah,
though, Justin.
Yeah,
we already
sure.
have that.
Right. Well, it's a question of, do you want more of it? And do you want to win that game? Or do you want to try to find some sort of intersubjective calibration method? That's the choice,
Can we let Michael speak, please?
Of course.
Okay. So I would be disappointed if the takeaway of my point of view was entirely, reality is a social construct or something, because I've been really trying to advocate for something much fuzzier and more complex and interesting. And part of the reason why maybe I can't necessarily articulate a clear epistemology from it is because I think it is still in the making, though say we can learn, say, from philosophers like Edmund Husserl. But for me, and as an example, there really is a place for a more participatory form of knowledge that can lead to better results. So as an example, something like public health, as we currently envision it, again, is very top-down. There is the experts who know, who kind of hold onto the knowledge for how to keep people healthy. And then these poor yokels and rubes just have to be told to do this, told to do that. But in a way that actually bypasses a more interesting point, which is that if you empower people to know and give people the access to knowledge, not only is public health just more efficiently done, it's done in a way that's more responsive to people to people's needs. And this is something that people have been researching. So
can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
What is your method for sorting the true from the false? You're constantly referring to it being possible for human beings to find their way towards what is real and true and away from what is false. You clearly believe in that. So if not scientific protocol, if not scientific method,
it is scientific though. It's just one. I'm just calling for what many critical scientists have been recognizing for a long time, which is that a blunt positivistic materialism needs to be incorporated with a human perspective that recognizes.
But who decides, Michael? Who decides? Who gets to decide?
We are doing that right now.
Michael's team.
Jules got the answer right. It's implicitly the team of judges that you think are the good correct judges.
I think that's a problem.
Dictator Michael.
It's a serious problem.
Not the dictator. Hold on. Not the dictator.
I just want to tie a couple things together and then we can come back because a lot of this came from censorship. So you have people have anxieties about censorship and totalitarianism. You have people with deep emotional ties to historic territories like Russia, and they're looking at Jeff Bezos, Lex Luthor in a mech suit with the frickin' super blimp and the drones, and they're looking at the genetic engineering. They're looking at Google with the robot army, and people are going, how is this stuff going to order? And you look at what's going on in China, and you see the censorship just totally off the rails over there. And you look at extreme cases like North Korea, it's much smaller. It's reasonable to be proactive now. And we started with the censorship talking about the brain thing and its genes. These are the two problematic subjects on the left and the right. The left wants you to say the human brain doesn't have a lot of differences between the sexes. And the right, apparently, like this guy we had on our show, Sunny, they want to talk about genetic clades. They want to basically use the tools to look at small things and start categorizing how genes work.
I feel like I'm the only person in this chat who identifies as a Democrat, which is weird because I'm the only combat vet here.
I think it's a generational thing. You're a bit older. Younger people see all the parties as kind of hopeless.
I would probably be conservative in normal times, but because of where we're at, I consider myself Democrat, but only just.
I've only ever voted for Democrats, for what it's worth, before I stopped voting, which was like the last election. But yeah.
I think first of all, I'm very surprised my friend Justin over here going so hard with the scientific method stuff. I mean, where is the room for, I guess you could say the mysticism, but what the professor brought up, I think is a good critique. I think our experts have totally failed us. I think that the expert managerial class is the biggest enemy to sort of any sort of understanding there is. But that being said, my concern is that what we're witnessing right now, the discourses we have in society at large, is that it's replacing one form of elitism for a sort of, let's call it, you mentioned the policing issue. I do agree there are many issues with policing that are the problem. I think community policing is something we could look at. But I, the response that we're getting with the defund the police thing is indicative, I think, of where the discourse, no, but hear me out. I think the problem is that it's indicative of the discourse that is the predominant progressive married to neoliberal capital discourse, in that, yes, defund the police, but what it's replacing it with is another form of soft sort of medicalization and expertism with social work and health experts. The experts are going to be parachuted in instead of the cops with rubber bullets and so forth. I think this is another thing we have to question, because it seems that a lot of the discourse is sort of taking a...
I'd rather experts over cops, to be frank.
Yeah, exactly. No, because this is the thing. A lot of these people that talk about defunding the police, they've read Discipline and Punch, but they haven't read the chapters from Foucault about governmentality and biopower. And that's the problem. We have to...
I have not read those chapters. Please, I don't even know which book you're referring to. Please inform me.
To answer your question, John, I think to bring up, you know, because I did a lot of research in grad school about Foucault, the thesis of the carceral regime in society, how the prisons are similar to the schools, to similar to the hospitals, and how they developed over time into new discourses of science and objectivity and methods of gathering and collecting data and so forth. This has created structures and apparatuses of surveillance and disciplining of the subject and so forth. I think that's a valid critique. My concern is that the people that take up these discourses, now they're saying, well, okay, we're going to impose our own regimes of truth with even more experts, and we're going to get rid of the hard power elites, which are the police, and they're terribly abusive. I've never supported the excesses of the police force. But at the same time, the other option is this soft power regime that are taken up with a lot of the issues that me and Justin and Verse and what we're talking about with this sort of predominant, let's call it woke capital discourse. So I think this is why we should question our assumptions. I would push back on the thing about scientism and objective truth.
I think we should bring it back to Plato, because I think it's a really good point. And it's super relevant for everything we've talked about today and for this conversation that's transpired today. And I'll break it down real quick for you, John. Probably the most relevant, I mean, Jules mentioned the forums, that's famous, right? Platonism is essentially this idea that the truth exists in abstract ideals, which we never fully access. Everything else, yeah, okay, so you're good with that. But the most relevant aspect, I think, for the current discussion is this concept of the noble lie. It's super important. So basically, Plato, in Plato's Republic, he literally pretty much explicitly says that it is the job of the philosopher king to essentially promote no falsehoods that he knows to be false, essentially, but that are in the good, that are in the interest of the people. That's essentially what the noble lie is. That Plato says it's good to promote lies if it is truly in the interest of the people. That's a very cartoonish summary.
This is what I've been arguing that you support to begin with. I thought it is, from what I'm hearing from pretty much everybody in this discussion, you guys all want a philosopher king.
No. Here's where let me finish my thought. So I'm just laying the basics. That's the basic idea of the noble lie. It's a very, very cartoonish summary. The reason it's relevant here is because it's essentially at the core of the debate that I was having with Michael. And namely, I actually represent Aristotle and Michael represents Plato. So Aristotle is known for being the empiricist. He's the opposite of the Platonic forms. Aristotle says, start with the data. Just go into the data, go and catalog all the different animals, catalog all the humans, catalog the different forms of society and the different ways of arranging your household. And by simply submitting to the truth of what you find in the data, you're able
no disagreement here.
You're able to then back out a kind of scientific model of how things should really be. And interestingly, there's a line from Aristotle up to Marx, even in the concept of flourishing. It's also a Christian idea. So the idea is that if you're scientific about things and you just basically focus on the data as objectively as possible, you can actually get to something like the core of human nature. And from there, make reasonable estimations about what it means for a good life, what it means to flourish as a human being. So that's an Aristotelian line. That is a core aspect of Marx, which a lot of people don't realize. Then there is this Platonic form, this Platonic kind of lineage in the political cleavages that we're going through today, which is the Platonic line. And the noble lie here is really important because essentially, if I understand Michael correctly, and I don't want to recapitulate Michael's arguments when he's not here, but to be as charitable as possible, I think he would you know, on some level agree with this. Michael was essentially representing the position, which is the dominant position on the left, which is that there are certain highly undesirable political outcomes that are so severe, so horrible. We are so concerned about avoiding certain political outcomes that it is necessary and good and just for smart people who know what the ethical and moral truth is, who know what the better positions are. It is good and necessary and proper for them to use whatever political forces they have available to them to make sure that those morally good ideas are the ones that dominate politically.
Guys, I think we should explain a bit more about the noble life. First of all, I would contend, and I wouldn't be doing proper academic work if I didn't, there's a debate within Platonic studies. I know because I had a professor who was like a big Platonist, right? That whether he really meant a political project or whether it was a metaphysical doctrine that manifested into a political doctrine. If you're Badiou, yes, political doctrine. If you are Strauss, not so much, right? So, but my point is, I think we should enumerate what the noble lie is. It's a tripartite soul noble lie. So there are a class of people who are the appetitive thumos. Oh, no, sorry, that's the second one. The appetitive type, they're based on an alchemical metal. There are three classes. They are all given a metal to represent them. That's the noble lie. So the first one is brass, if I recall correctly. They're the bottom, you know, maggot, bootlicker, common mass individual. They are the appetitive type. They can just consume, you know, get excited for new products, that type of class, right? That's the vast
people.
Majority of
the
people.
NPCs, basically.
The NPCs, that's right.
The second class is the Thumos class, the Kshatriya class, the warriors. They are the ones who act. They're the spirit, Thumos, will, volitional part of the soul of the book. Because remember, the soul in the city in Plato, it's the same, right? You are a reflection of your social environment around you. The top is the philosopher king. They're the intellect. They're the Brahmin. They are the gold caste, right? So this is the argument that the left is enacting a Platonic political project. I think we have to give credence to the fact that a lot of this discourse of, let's call it progressive modernity, relies on the fact that certain people have a fundamental positional will within them that is almost alchemical, that is almost they can't get rid of the original sin, that they're evil, racist, terrible. And I think that's why they say that the higher class, using the Kshatriya class, and I would also include activists, social workers, experts as the Kshatriya middle will class, because they're the ones doing the canceling, along with Twitter activists.